Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I'm very excited because this was a podcast. I think it's fair to say this was a long time coming. I've got Renetta Amador with me. Hi, Renetta.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, and it's good to have you here. I won't bother saying, I don't have no idea how many times we had to reschedule this, but you are a very busy, very active person in the film industry, and you get great jobs, and then we had to reschedule this. So it's great to have you here in person. We are in the same room. And Renetta is here, both to tell me all about herself and her career, but also we're going to talk about the film Processing, which is her, well, you directed it and produced it. And your friend Cliff Smith wrote it?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So that was an official selection at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2021. And I'm very happy to say it is in the Discover Indie Film TV series, which is something that I'm very happy about. And it's also on TV High, which I'm happy about. So the two fun little post-festival projects I do to try to help get films out and get eyeballs on them, Renetta was game. You were game and you did them both. So thank you so much.
Oh, it was very exciting. Very excited to be a part of both and to be a part of the community.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to say this while we're getting recorded. For a long time, I've been like, all through COVID, I'm like, when COVID ends, I'm going to have a Discover Indie Film party in the backyard and invite all the filmmakers who've contributed to Discover Indie Film to like come hang out and meet each other. And COVID's been over for over a year and I haven't done it. So now you can hold me to that.
I will. I think that as an independent filmmaker, especially with shorts, it can be a very isolating experience. You have very little crew and you're usually doing 10,000 jobs at once by yourself. So getting to know other filmmakers would be amazing and learning, you know, ways in which you can collaborate and help one another.
Right. And to be around people who know what it's like when you're the director and producer. You also did catering. You did this, you did that, like all these,
exactly.
all this shit you had to do to get your vision on screen. But, oh, you know what I didn't say is that, so if you want to see Processing, yeah, there's couple ways to do it, but first you could go to Amazon Prime Video and type in Discover Indie Film, and I always say watch it on a nice big TV, because by the way, this film looks beautiful, so you definitely don't want to watch it on your phone unless like you hold it really close, like right up to your nose, I guess. But anyway, go to Amazon Prime Video and just type in Discover Indie Film and enjoy Processing. It's in season 7, and you can also go to watchtvhi.com, TVHI, so watchtvhi.com, which is a relatively new streaming service and or smart TV app that's on Roku, Apple TV, Android TV, Amazon Fire TV, and Android Mobile and iPhone. It's in all those app stores. If you just search for TVHI, and yeah, it's a streaming service where all the films are wonderful indie films that are great to watch in any state. But if you can be a responsible drug user, and I have friends in recovery, so I don't take things lightly, but if you can enjoy marijuana without having a negative effect on your life, then all the content on TV High is going to be just a little better for you. But it's good no matter what. I don't know. I'm of the age where I still can't sit comfortably with the idea of like, yeah, weed's legal. Like 35 states now or something?
Oh, are we up to 35?
I don't know. I pulled that out of my butt. But anyhow, so now we've covered that stuff. And I warned you, Renetta, that I was just going to say, you know, you're this creative, productive person. And I know you work all the time. So you want to just share how you got involved in film and how young you were when you caught the bug?
Well, it was actually a very slow process for me. I grew up in the Bible Belt of Texas. It was incredibly hot, 118 degrees in the summer. And so we didn't play outside, clearly, but my mom would take me every day and I would rent 2 movies a day during the summer. So I just loved movies. I always loved film. And then, you know, at a certain point, and culturally speaking, I was told to do something more responsible. And so I became a social worker. And I did that And then one day I literally just woke up and was like, this isn't my life.
But that was like after going to college.
And I went to college. I got a degree.
Yeah.
And I was in the field. And I just, I was sad all the time. I worked with teenagers and in Texas and, you know, worked with the GLBT youth population. And so there wasn't a lot of happiness. And I was like, I need a break and maybe I'll come back to this, but I need to do something that's just going to make me happy. And I went online and I searched jobs in film and I saw script supervisor. And I was like, okay, that's it. And 3 weeks later, I was living in LA. I put whatever would fit into my car, drove out to LA, I think $300 to my name. And I began the process of hustling. I found a man who said he would train me, and I did not know who he was. And it turned out he had been the script supervisor on Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, The Searchers. And for 6 months, every Saturday, 10 to 12 hours, I just went to his place and he trained me.
I got to ask, like, how did you find him?
It was just a random series of phone calls. Texas is a right-to-work state, so I didn't know anything about unions. But then you come to LA, and this was back in 2000, and everything's union. And so I made some calls. I found out about the union. I called the union. The union was like, hey, we know this guy. He teaches sometimes. Call him. And so I just called some random dude and was like, this is who I am. So I was very, very fortunate. I got incredibly good training. But again, this was 23 years ago. So there was no social media. There's no real way to meet other people.
But also, I'm sure he could tell that you were like for real and driven.
Exactly. I mean, I was, you know, I was older. I'd already had another career. And his whole thing was that nobody really knew what script supervisors did or do. And so before he would teach you, he had to make sure that you had a good understanding of the job, how important it was, how seriously it was to be taken. And then he would teach you. But you had to know all these things.
He must have been a natural teacher because that almost sounds like a calling in a way.
You know, he was really an amazing teacher. And, you know, noticing that I had no money ever, he also gave me odd jobs and gave me a really strange and interesting introduction into Hollywood. He asked me if I would clean houses. And I'm like, sure. At this point, if it's got money, I'll do it. And sent me to the house across the street. And I cleaned this man's house and I couldn't figure out like what these big file cabinets were for. And it turned out they were photo file cabinets and the man was Phil Stern. He had taken all the pictures of James Dean, the sweater over his mouth, you know, Marilyn Monroe, and sadly had emphysema and was dying, needed help. So I helped him and got to know this amazing man. Then he asked me to go help out this lady he rented an apartment to. So I just went. I never asked questions. I maybe should have. And that woman had been in a relationship with, what's the guy's name that did Faster Pussycat Kill Kill?
I used to know it. It's on the tip of my tongue. You want me to look it up?
Yes.
Russ Meyer.
Russ Meyer, yes. She was a Russ Meyer girl. She was his partner for years and years and years. Her stage name was Kitna Tavidad.
Oh, she's huge.
She's huge. I had no
huge
clue.
Huge, famous.
I met her as Francesca. But then she was offering me odd jobs, which I'll just leave it at that. And I was like, I should really look and see who this woman is. And that's when I found out her story. I eventually got a house-sitting job by a man I'm still friends with and knew nothing about him. Realized he had written, don't tell mom the babysitter's dead. So every turn I took was just this weird, fascinating little piece of history in Hollywood. So I feel I was very fortunate.
But also you weren't, you had a good attitude towards, instead of just like, turning your nose up at these kinds of jobs and things.
Exactly.
You were like willing to do it and you met people who could be important that way. And it's like way smarter to do that than to like come to town and be like, I'm not going to do, you know, any, you know what I mean? The attitude that some kids of privilege come here with. You know, I'm like, what do you want to do? You want to be a barista or you want to, you know, walk a producer's dog? I say walk the producer's dog.
100%. One of the most fascinating jobs I did was telefundraising. I was horrible. I mean, every day I was on the verge of getting fired. I was getting cussed at on a daily basis by people hanging up on me. I mean, it's a terrible job. However, it turned out that my boss played Pee-wee in Porky's. And every day he had to come out and give us this motivational speak about how we were going to raise that money. Did not work for me, but I tried. And I sat next to this woman who had just moved from New York, and she was not very, she was a little better at me at the job, but not much. And we would just sit there and talk every day about how we just hated this job. And we could not wait until we get out. And the thing about this job was it catered to people in the industry. So if you needed 30 days leave, you could take it and then come back to work. If you needed to miss 2 days of work, you could with 24 hours notice. So that's why we were all there, was that flexibility. But me and this woman every day would sit there and just daydream about being on a set where she was an actress and I was a script supervisor and it was going to happen one day. I went in to ask for my 30 days notice, and Dan Pee-wee was like, I will do you one better. I'm going to fire you. And I was like, but why? What did I do? I mean, I suck, but why? And he was like, we both know you don't belong here. And this is your crutch because you can get money. I'm going to fire you and you can't ever come back to work here if I do that. Go make your living as a script supervisor.
Right, because he knew what you wanted to do. And he, that's actually very empathetic.
Exactly. And it that changed everything for me because I was forced to only take those kind of jobs. And it was scary. And I think the theme of my transition into film was always about leaps of faith. You know, I would call my dad and I would cry and I'd be like, I made a mistake. I need to come home. And he'd be like, nope, there's nothing left for you in Texas. But here's $100, make it last 2 weeks. And so everything was just whether it was my own faith, which would come and go clearly, but the faith of people around me who I didn't know any of these people. And, you know, they were just like, keep going. But funny thing is, to wrap up that story, the woman next to me, next time I saw her, I'm on a bus and I'm doing a little horror movie called Evidence and I'm working as a script supervisor. My director, the AD, the DP, they were all over 6 feet tall. And since you can't see me, I am 5'1" on a good day. And so we're rehearsing and I can't see around them. But I hear somebody say, Renetta Amador, what are you doing here? And when I looked around them, it was the woman from the telefundraising place who happened to be Del Dickey, who went on to be in My Name is Earl and Domino, and she played the wolf mother in True Blood, and she made it. And we just sat there and we both started crying because it was just so weird. We were like, holy crap. Here we are.
That's kind of like two lottery winners in the same room.
You know, and people are just staring at us like, what the hell is wrong with you people? But we're like, you just don't even get it. Like, we sat next to each other in that crappy job, but so happy to be there because it allowed us the freedom to also be creative. And I realized from that experience that just because you're in Hollywood and you're trying to be in film, but you're not doing film, doesn't mean you're not taking steps towards your career and what you're meant to do. You know, it really laid out for me that every step you take, you know, really does get you to where you need to be. And, you know, like you were talking about pet sitting, you know, dog walking. And I did that. And I ended up script supervising for that guy short who was an editor for the Jay Leno show. Like, I never really went in there knowing who people were because I wasn't born and raised here. And I wasn't in the film community. And back then, their social media wasn't a presence. But I wasn't afraid to say yes. I just said yes. I mean, I'd get invited to screenings and the person inviting me wouldn't even show up, but I would still go.
I mean, it reminds me of the actors I've known. And I mean, I've been around here for 40 years or so. And you know, the actors who would like refuse to do a student film or something when they were while bartending. And it's like, why aren't you taking every opportunity you get to act? Like, why say no to things when all it can do is lead to something?
Listen, I tell people all the time, years ago, I did a movie with America Ferrera, and she had a stand-in. And this girl was great. She was so nice, and she was willing to do whatever it took. You know, the movie came out, but I remember she had such a dynamic personality that the director, who coincidentally I've been with now for 14 years, you know, working side by side with him, he was like, you know what? I'm going to put her in the scene. It was a wedding movie. He was like, she's going to be a bridesmaid dancing on the table. And she did it. I mean, she took every opportunity. America asked her to go to New York, be her stand-in on Ugly Betty. She did it. That girl was Gina Rodriguez. You know, and I think about that a lot when I have stand-ins and I have extras and background actors come up to me and say, how do I make it? And I'm like, say yes. Don't be afraid to say yes, because you can't judge what any project will do. You know, I took Promising Young Woman and they were like, it's tier one, it doesn't pay any money. And I'm like, oh, you aren't kidding about that. But I liked it. And I had, you know, it was 5 weeks. So I'm like, in and out, let's do it. I mean, who knew that it was going to be the force that it was? You know, there's no way of judging. You just have to take things that feel good to you and that you like. And that sounds so cliche, but keeping true to yourself on that path really will open up the door to much bigger, better things.
The other cliche, I think, that probably is going to apply, and you're not boastful, so you wouldn't say this, but you obviously did a good fucking job as a scriptee too. Like to get hired over and over, like a lot of people, I mean, that's a tough job. I don't think people realize when they hear the word script supervisor
that
it's probably, there's more weight on that person than almost anyone knows, because you have to be so detail oriented. And if you make any mistakes, it actually really does screw shit up all the way to the edit, right?
What's interesting is everybody assumes that script supervisors only deal with continuity. And if that was the case, there would never be a mistake ever. And the truth of the matter is, for everything that happens, I'll give an example. The same America Ferrera movie, the girl who played her sister had on ginormous hoop earrings and a ponytail. So basically, after take three, I notice she's lost an earring. We cannot find that earring to save our life. We can't find it. We don't know where it's at. There's not a double. We're in the middle of nowhere. It is. So what do? Do you take the other earring off, or do you just try to keep coverage on one side and hope nobody notices? What do? So that was what they decided, just to kind of cover it from one side and maybe use the prior takes, you know, hoping they work. I write big notes to the editor. Please be aware. There's an earring missing. Don't use. Blah, blah, blah. Get to the movie. One earring. Plain as day. I'm just like, okay, you know, this is happening.
Yeah, because they had an artistic choice and that was more important to them. Yeah.
And really, you know, and they say this and it's like a eye roll moment, but it's true. Like if your content is engaging, you're not noticing stuff like that. I mean, I go to movies all the time and people are like, did you see that mistake? And I'm like, no, because I'm watching the performance. Like, I don't care about that right now. I'm not scripty. But there's so much more that goes into it. You know, it's not just the continuity of things, but it's also the story. Does the story track? Does the look track? Does he... In horror, especially, we'll get into horror a little bit. I have done so many movies that take place in 24 hours. Insidious doesn't take place in 24 hours, but it's a very short time frame. Then 31, 24 hours. And the thing about that is, what people don't think about is you have to have a degradation of your characters. Everybody always starts out looking great, but by the end of it, they look like crap. So where do you start making them look worse, worse, worse? Because you're not shooting in order. So that's also part of it. Do their emotions match at the end with where they're coming from? So it's a complicated job with lots of moving parts that you have to think about.
Lots of moving parts and critical. And that's critical to the director.
100%. The director I mentioned before that I've worked with for 14 years, we have such a shorthand that people make fun of us because we don't even speak words. I'm like, did you see the? Yeah, I thought it was a little. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Again, you know. But you work so side by side with that director, helping him to get his vision. You're watching every detail so that they don't have to. So that they can look at the performance, they can look at the camera moves, they can look at, you know, the look, the style. And so they really go hand in hand. And it can be frustrating because the trend has gotten to be where a lot of directors, which is great that a lot of first-time directors are getting their chance and their moment, but they don't take the time to really learn how to utilize the crew. And that would be a big advice to me to future directors. Learn how to utilize your crew and what they do. They're not there to fight against you and go against what you want. They're trying to help you get what you want. And when there's so much pressure and so many voices, it could really feel like too much. But if you allow that relationship to grow and be brought in, it only makes your stuff better. Also, you know, as a script supervisor, I never set out, all of this was never a big grand plan for me, clearly. I'm maybe too much of a say yes girl. I didn't save up the money and come to LA in a smart manner. Didn't happen. I was so clueless to the business. I thought, oh, I'll do some TV. I'll do some movies. I'll do some commercials. I'll just bounce around. That's not how the business works. You usually kind of get on a track and that's where you're at. You're in TV, you're in film, you're in commercials. I was fortunate enough. I love movies and I was lucky enough that that's where my path took me, was in film. And I've been a script supervisor for 23 years. And what has happened is over the course of that 23 years and being a script supervisor, working so closely with a director, I have worked alongside some of the best and some of the not so best, some of the, you know, that aren't so great and could, you know, use a little growth. But it's all such an amazing learning experience. It was the best school I could have ever gotten. And so throughout that process, it occurred to me that I had stories I wanted to tell and I had ways in which I wanted to tell them. And I love horror. I've always loved horror. The movies I was renting, you know, Scanners and Nightmare on Elm Street and, you know, The Shining, all of that stuff. Going to the movies to see The Howling and The Beast Within, I couldn't get enough of it. And so when I decided I wanted to tell my story, that's where my path took me, was in horror. I was getting into processing, I was on a movie called The Curse of La Llorona. And the writer, who's lovely and become a dear friend of mine, came up to me and she said, "You're ready to direct and I have a movie for you." And I was like, and at the time it was still kind of like a little thought, but not a reality. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'll read it. And I read it and it was a movie called Within. It was amazing. And I said, nobody's going to give a script supervisor 1.5 to make this movie. That's what you need. I had done enough movies at the $1.5 million level that I knew, like Lords of Salem, Three from Hell, Insidious 2, like, that's the level this needs to be at. And they're not going to give it to a script supervisor who's never directed. That's just reality. I said, however, if you can get the writer to pull out a short film, I promise I will do everything in my power to make this short and direct it. And that's where processing came from.
And let me ask, Did you secretly, did you have that directing desire as well for a while, and then this person recognized it? Or did that approach sort of set off a light bulb?
I think it was both. Like, it was in the back of my head. But again, you know, starting in this business 23 years ago, women don't become directors. You know, just be happy you have a successful career as a script supervisor.
Yeah, like all directors were white males.
Exactly. And that's another thing. For those who can't see me, I am a Hispanic female. And so really, you don't see Latina females out there directing any kind of content. It had been in the back of my mind, but it never really seemed like it could be a reality. So it's not something I let grow. And then the moment she mentioned it, I was like, it's time. She's right. Let's do this. So it took us a year to develop processing into a script, because again, it came from a feature. It was very surreal story. So it was creatively, you know, the story really goes about what you see versus what is the actual reality. You know, is what is real and what isn't real. And to create that on a shoestring budget, you know, if I had access to $1.5 million, I could do whatever I wanted. But that's
not. You could have done the feature, yeah.
I could have done the feature. But that wasn't reality. So it was really tricky getting that script developed to where it was. It was very important to me that, you know, the audience could follow it. And even though it was a little surreal and abstract, can still get it. I didn't want it to be so ambiguous that they were frustrated. So we really hashed out that script for a while. Cliff would write it, send it to me. I'd mark it all up in my red pen, send it back. Then I think the first draft he sent me was like 20 pages. And I'm like, that's cute. Shorten it. Okay, we don't need this. Take it out. Like, just, and he was lovely to work with.
And you were looking at it as much as a producer, as a director, right? Because it sounds like you were very budget conscious and very reality conscious.
Yeah, what happened was I had to, because through various reasons, I lost two producers in that year. Personal family matters came up. And time doesn't stop. And so we were getting closer and closer. I had two actors I had already booked to be in it. One was Hannah Mae Lee, who did The Babysitter and Pitch Perfect. She and I had actually worked on The Babysitter together. And then a good friend of mine of like 10 years was James Michael Tyler, who had played Gunther on Friends. And so both of them separately had come to me and said, we want to see you direct, so find something and we'll do it. I found this, so that meant more script changes because, you know, ethnicities, like voices, everything changed when I put those two in that place. But, you know, I didn't have a producer, so I ended up having to do that myself. I was working on average 94 hours a week on a TV series. So I'd come home at night and work on it. I'd work it on the weekends, then I'd go back to work. And
so that's like 6 15-hour days? Or is it 7 days a week?
It was 5 days a week, like 17 hours, 18 hours.
Jesus. Just no sleep.
No sleep whatsoever. And then, you know, so all this is going on. We had a budget and 3 weeks. And we had somebody who was on board to finance, and then 3 weeks before they bailed. So here I am with everything set up, actors, locations, producing it myself, directing it myself, and now we don't have any money. So I ended up draining my savings. I literally called my bank and was like, I need to further my career. I can't do it without an extra $5,000. And within 24 hours, they gave me the loan. I still do not know why they did it, but they did it. And I'm so grateful.
I bet they have. I bet for that amount, they sort of have, like a bank manager might have a little leeway, like
right,
a loan
and
manager.
It helps that.
Because you're not asking for like 150.
No. And yeah. I'm one of these people that I kind of do things and because I think they might be a good idea. And like 8 years prior to that, just for no reason, I took out a $5,000 loan with them. I didn't need it, but I was like, oh, debt consolidation. And I paid it off in half the time. My thought was, well, what if I want a car? At least I show them I'm good for it. So I think that helped. Like, I had no clue that that's how it would come into play. But I was always kind of planning like that.
You'd proved you're not deadbeat material. Yeah, for sure.
I was like, for sure. I'm good for it. Like, yes, I don't have a job right now because by this point the show had ended. And I'm like, but I promise I'm good for it. But, you know, I lost my funding 3 weeks before. I had found out that my friend Michael, the lead, had stage 4 cancer. And so pushing was not an option because he was starting treatment. It hadn't been released to the press that he had cancer, so we couldn't tell anybody. We just had to get it done. I could not adjust my days at all. And then I ended up really without a production designer. So I had to learn how to build sets because I had to build 2 rooms. And it was.
And for those who haven't seen the film yet, there's one room that probably wasn't too big a challenge and another that was a massive challenge.
100%. 100%.
I mean, this was some serious production design.
It was. I just felt like I can remember at one point calling my mom, crying, hyperventilating, and being like, what am I doing? And I should just pull the plug. And she was like, you're not going to pull the plug. Your father and I have a credit card that we paid off. Here you go. But you have to pay it off. And bless my parents' hearts. I know not everybody's fortunate enough to have supportive parents. Mine do not have money and they don't have a lot of, you know, extra, but they were like, you need to do this and here you go. And so I just kept pushing forward. And it was tough. It was the hardest thing I'd ever did. And when I got the footage, I couldn't even look at it. And so I met with my editor and I handed it to her. I started crying and was just like, I don't know what's on there. I hope I have a short. I knew that there was a couple of things missing because of time constraints. And I was really concerned about that. But she sent me the first cut.
I'm gonna cut you off.
Sure.
So the on-set directing experience.
Oh.
How'd you feel? How that,
you know,
cause you had been, I mean, had been brewing for a long time and here you are also getting to direct friends, which I think is kind of special.
Yeah. You know, my one regret of the whole experience was that I wish I could have just been a director because I'm directing and then being like, what do you mean catering's late? Like, I don't care what happens. We need catering. I haven't been a crew member for so long. There were just things that weren't negotiable to me. They had to eat well. We got a cafe who gave us a discount, who made organic food from scratch and fed everybody. No matter what it was, everybody, including the PAs, got paid something. And we didn't keep them over 12 hours. Like, I just wouldn't do it. And so I wish I could have just been 100% director and not think about these things. A lovely friend of mine who was a script supervisor as well, she since quit, but she stepped up to help me kind of co-produce and, you know, just deflect things. But the actual moments where I got to direct was creatively the most fulfilling thing I've ever done in my life. And
I'm giving a golf clap across the table from you because that's lovely. I'm so glad you had a great experience.
It was, you know, at the end of the day, with everything that went wrong, and so much went wrong, it was unlike anything I'd ever felt before. And being able to get in there and really work with the actors and talk with them about their characters and create interesting ways to shoot it. And learning what to let go was just as important as learning what to fight for. I really wanted a like 2 minute Steadicam shot to open up the main part of the short. And you know, one of my producers, just the second one that left, just could not handle that. He was like, every first time director wants that. You're going to be sad when you don't have coverage. And I'm like, but if I can't try it now, it's my money. It's my short. I've put in the work to build this place. Literally, if you can't do it now, when can you take those chances? And I just need to make sure I choreograph it well. And I'm of the school of thought, you don't need to see every line on screen. You just need to hit the important ones. And so that's what I did.
And good for you.
Yeah, it was scary because, you know, I knew that that was going to make him walk. And it was going to fall on me. And I was under so much pressure already, but I wouldn't change it. And now it's kind of become my thing because I've directed another one since then. And I'm like, okay, we're going to open this up with a minute Steadicam. but, you know, I encourage everybody to try it. Even if you don't want to be a director, if you want to be a producer, you want to, you know, be a script supervisor, it gives you such a better understanding of the entire filmmaking process. And that's something else I tell, you know, production assistants when they're like, I want to be a producer. I'm like, walk in everybody's shoes because you will know how to utilize them. You will know when they're, you know, playing tricks on you. You will know everything because you know what they do and you know what it takes. And so that was one of the most amazing experiences. And sadly, it was the last time Michael ever acted. And so it was truly just a special moment. You know, you don't ever think about life in terms of that. We were all hoping for a better outcome with his treatment. But to know that I got to share that with him, and he was so proud of it. You know, processing will always hold a special place for me.
Yeah, no, that's extra special. I don't want to derail you. Cancer has been a big part of my life, and it's ridiculous how many close friends have dealt with it, including stage four, sadly ovarian, which you almost never get through. But
right.
But and of course, always discovered during a pregnancy, which is even worse. But anyway, idea that you have this experience where you also got to, you know, you got to make your friend a lead actor in something and preserve it. Like, that's huge.
I mean, you know, playing Gunther was so special to him. I mean, he actually bought.
And he was severely memorable.
Oh.
Gunther stood out. One of the most watched shows in history. No one wouldn't know the name Gunther.
What's funny is that I actually never saw Friends. I'm one of those weirdos. I didn't watch a lot of TV. I was too busy watching movies. And also at that time that Friends came out, I was in college. And, you know, it was much more complicated to watch TV back then. You had a VCR and you had to set timers. It was a mess. But, you know, he was so proud of it, but he also really wanted to show that he could do more. And so I was very happy that he got to see that he won several awards for best acting before he passed. He passed in the middle of our festival run. But I was so happy he at least got to see that he was winning. So
it's wonderful.
It's amazing. And I'm happy that I could do that for him. And if it wasn't for him constantly encouraging me to do it, you know, I wouldn't have. I like I said, I have not been short on people having faith in me. And I do not forget that or take that lightly. And it serves as sort of a responsibility for me in what I make.
I mean, I have to compliment you as well. Besides him, also, like, the other friend you mentioned, Haname Lee, like, she, I guess I'll just get, I don't want to get too political, but she is always so typecast in other things.
100%.
And in your film, she just gets to act. Like, she gets to be a person, a character in power doing something. And everything else I've seen her in, and probably because Pitch Perfect is how Hollywood discovered her.
Right.
But they you know, they treat her like the Asian woman in the script. Like, it's very typecast, what I've seen her do other than Processing.
I am very fortunate that she's such a good friend of mine. And, you know, had realized early on that struggle. It was very important to me to find something that she could do that had nothing to do with her ethnicity. It just was her creating this character. And with both of them, it's like a 15-minute short. But with both of their characters, I did an incredible breakdown of where these people came from in their lives. You know, where Michael's character came from to, and the other underlying nuances for him. And I did the same for her, but with her input, we sat down and we spent a long time talking about where this person came from. I let her choose the name because I changed the name of the script. Cause you know, I couldn't have her be like Elena Rodriguez, but, you know, but I let her have a really big say on who this person was. And I think that that really helped give it authenticity. And yeah, we're excited. We're looking for something else to do. I've got a couple of pitches out right now. And I'm like, by the way, I put you in my book. Like, because I just feel like I have to be careful how I say this. I know there's, at the end of the day, actors are actors. They're supposed to be able to play anything and embody any character and have the freedom to do so. And right now we're at a time where it's very tricky and it's very judged. And there's a fine line in saying that Asian actors can only play Asian characters. And this woman who happens to be Asian is an amazing actress and can play anything she wants. And so I try to be very conscious of that. And if I'm going to pick, and I do have some stories I want to tell where, you know, I have in my dream book of people to play the roles, I have trans actors. But I never want to call attention to the fact that they're trans. Being trans has nothing to do with, you know, what this role is. The fact that they're an actor who I feel like has the chops to really bring it to life is why I'm choosing them. You know, I'm not, I don't think they want to, you know, anybody wants to be typecast as something. I think everybody wants to be challenged and seen for more than.
I mean, I guess it's always been tough, but this is a particularly tough era because there's such a microscope on it.
Exactly.
And the microscope has always been on the whitewashing problem. But it's also hard to focus on the typecasting problem, too. It's such a challenge.
It's a very tricky line. And as I said, you know, I've been working on a few pitches and lookbooks and in really having to dive into characters and actors and who, you know, and really thinking, what does that mean? You know, and at the end of the day, I'm going to put somebody down that I just point blank feels I can do the part. And again, like nobody in Processing when we wrote it had the names we wrote because we just went off the rails with who we chose in a lovely way. But it does make things a little difficult. You know.
Yeah, and like we said before we started recording, we live in multicultural Los Angeles and it's a nice little bubble, I think, of multiculturalness. The idea that when you cast, you just cast the best actors. And if you have to change a name, you change a name. But it's not, you know, that's how it should be.
100%. We're just not quite there yet. I think we tried to get there and we went way far in one direction. And now we're coming back a little bit, trying to find the happy spot of it. you know, and I think about it in regards to myself, I have never felt more Latina than when I've been trying to direct, because I'm constantly told that I'm Latina. Well, you're a Latina female director. It's going to be harder for you. You're going to have to prove yourself more. Okay, but, you know, I'm also just a director.
Yeah, I mean, what do you do with that? You have to just shove it aside and say, fuck it.
Exactly, and that's kind of how I ended up where I did shooting my second short, is I kept getting told, you know, processing won so many awards. And, you know, it was almost, this sounds so stupid, but it was almost embarrassing how many awards we won. But I couldn't believe that so many people loved this film that was just such really like bloodshed, you know, and tears, blood, sweat, and tears, as they say. But afterwards, you know, with every award show, it'd be me and four guys standing up there at the directors. It was always me and a bunch of guys. And I think there was one festival where there was me and another girl and a bunch of guys that were the directors. And I noticed that they all did not have problems getting their next project. It was like pulling teeth. And so I went out of a meeting with a producer who, off the record, told me, as a Latina female, I had to work twice as hard to prove myself. And I even had a producer tell me that she would never take chance on a first-time female director, especially not knowing if you knew how to conduct yourself on set. And I'm like, I've been on sets for 23 years. A script supervisor knows more than anybody how to deal with actors and producers and every department head, and that's everybody we work with. But it made me so angry that I was like, okay, fine, here you go. And I called up my friends in the Dominican Republic, and I was very fortunate that as a script supervisor, I did two back-to-back movies for a total of 7 months out there and became very good friends with their international crew. And I was like, your girl needs to direct something else. People are trying to keep me down. And that's what I did last summer. I flew to the DR and we shot another short. And we shot it in English and Spanish. And I'm like, okay, you know, is that diverse enough for you? Like,
so funny. My brain is getting so weak in my mid-50s. But what's the... I don't want to sound like I'm trying to... I don't know. I forget what I want my preface for the statement to be, but like, it annoys the fuck out of me that what that producer said to you. How often does a dude hear, well, do you know how to conduct yourself? Like, never. It's such a bullshit comment. And you know, and by the way, and now we're well aware, although we always were, especially I'm sure you were always aware, right, for 23 years of how many assholes are on sets. But people didn't walk around going, Joss Whedon doesn't know how to conduct himself on set.
No. I worked with a director in the last several years who literally had complaint after complaint after complaint filed after on him. I'm talking with HR, with the studio. I've never seen so many complaints filed against a director. Nothing's going to ever happen. You know, he'll keep working and keep getting hired, and that's fine. I mean, that's his path to deal with. But don't tell me that
they're screening people for exactly how they had conduct themselves.
You know, you're not, you know. And I also, you know, I'm very thankful for the inclusion movement, but I still feel like it left out Latina representation. You know, I feel like you can name off the top of your head 5 African-American, 5 Asian, you know, female directors, 5 white female directors, but name 5 Latina ones. And you can't do it. I've seen them come through episodic television, not many, but where are the big names in film?
Yeah.
And I was talking to a friend of mine.
There's the trio of guys who came out of Mexico who
of course
get unfairly grouped together all the goddamn time.
Yeah. Like, as if they have the same style at all.
Yeah, as if they have anything to do with each other. It's maddening.
You know, I had a long talk with a friend of mine the last film that I did as a script supervisor. And he's African-American, and he was talking about, you know, he wants to get to a certain level of being above the line and how hard it is. And I'm like, but you have somebody to pull you through. You have people to look up to and say they've done it.
Yeah, and it's one of the, what is the word, flaws of our culture is that for 200 years we defined race as black and white.
Right.
And people who are neither black nor white got left out of the conversation almost all the time. And still.
My birth certificate says I'm Caucasian because Hispanic, Latina is not even a race.
Yeah. In fact, when you fill out forms, you say Caucasian, and then I have to check non-Latino Caucasian,
and
right?
I have to check the Hispanic.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, as good as a movement as it was, like Oscar So White, when that was a hashtag, it really wasn't intended to apply to anyone but the African-Americans who were being ignored.
100%. And like I said, like, it's about fucking time, like, that they get recognized. I am so happy. But in the same sense, who am I supposed to look up to?
And the numbers of the community are ridiculously large. So I mean, yeah, I mean, we've talked about parts of the world, but I mean, you know, how can Hollywood people live in Los Angeles and not be aware that, like, Hispanic people, they are our community. They are us. We are all together, like half the city. Like,
exactly.
How do you ignore half your own city?
It's the craziest thing to me. And I think that's why I became so attached to the Dominican Republic, is because working out there for the first time, 90% of the crew looked like me. And I ended up just always hanging out with them. And they took me in. And sadly, I do not speak Spanish because my mother, as we discussed earlier, is white. We're not sure where she comes from. But so she didn't speak it. They didn't speak it at home, and they were also instructed not to teach me because I'm from Texas, and they said if my parents wanted me to be educated and excel and compete, don't teach her Spanish. Clearly that thought has changed, but now here I am trying to learn Spanish.
That's just straight up racism.
It is.
And yet, well, it's how to function in a racist society, I guess. But as if being bilingual would never be an advantage.
Exactly.
And as if you couldn't speak, this is acknowledging how horrible parts of our culture are, but you could speak perfect white English. God, I hate saying that, but you could. You and still speak Spanish. Like, it wasn't like it would turn your English into an accented English. You're growing up in Texas with a white mom.
Right.
Like you definitely deserve to learn both.
I've had the strangest things said to me, especially since I've been in the business. I've done a lot of film dealing with African-American history. Selma, Birth of a Nation, Confirmation. I mean, Beyond the Lights, like, I've done a lot. And somebody told me once that I had job security because I was brown enough. And I'm like, what the hell does brown enough mean? Couldn't it be because I'm good at this job? Like, well, how did...
Because if you weren't,
like,
they wouldn't have you back.
That to me? Like, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And I'm just looking at them like, you know, you said that out loud. Even if you're thinking it, you said it out loud.
And they meant that you can get hired on a black majority production?
I think they just meant in general, because it was at the beginning of inclusion. It was at the beginning of the start of the inclusion movement.
Oh, so they were doing that reverse racism bullshit.
Yeah.
That, oh, now non-white people have a, as if it's a leg up to go from 1% to 5% of the
jobs. Exactly. And I'm like, I'm sitting here on a $150 million movie. Like, do you think I got here just because I was a political hire? Like, no, it took years of working my way up on this business and proving myself that I could do it.
Well, in the end, the studios, yeah, at that level, they only care about what's on screen. They don't Right. I mean, the to present to the public that they're woke or whatever term you want to use, they just have to, you know, tokenize. It's all so complicated.
It's been an interesting journey. And now the thing in my perfect dream life of a filmmaker, I noticed quite a while ago that there are certain positions in Hollywood where you don't have to choose. You can be a DP and direct a movie. You can be a writer and direct. You can be an editor and direct. You can produce and direct. You can write and produce. There's all of the, you know, you can be a showrunner and get an episode. You can be an actor and direct. But to sit there and say, I want to direct and I want to script supervise for this handful of people because I have these years of relationship with them. I like collaborating with them. And honestly, on film, directors get a film, once a year, once every other year, if they're lucky. You know, by the time you shoot it, then you spend the time in post, then you go out there and you do the press for it. You know, you're not ready to get back into the game for at least a year, maybe two. So in the downtime, why can't I direct? I have no confusion on what job I'm doing. When I get hired to do it, I don't cross the line. So why is it that you're making me choose? And so I feel like there's a lot of ground I'm trying to break. And, you know,
it's a ceiling. It's a type of glass ceiling.
100%. And so, you know, people are like, oh, so you want to get out of script supervising? And I'm like, not necessarily. I want to get out of having to say yes to every job because I have to pay the rent. I want to get to a point to where, and in some ways I'm at this point, but I want to be able to say, I want to work for you and I want to work for you because creatively that fulfills me. And in between, I want to direct my own stuff because honestly, the stuff I would work on with the handful of directors I'm thinking of, they don't do the stuff I would do. And so why can't, you know, to me, directing makes me a stronger script supervisor, knowing what they're going through and what they're looking for. But being a script supervisor makes me a stronger director.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. Not enough people blaze that trail before you. Hopefully you're blazing a trail for more.
Well, no, because, you know, honestly, most script supervisors who turn into directors just leave. And I get that too. Without getting too much into the logistics, it's a very hard job. We're the lowest paid key on set. We have, even compared to East Coast script supervisors, we make over $20 an hour less than they do doing the same job because we have bad contracts. You know, so when people see a chance to jump out and direct, they just leave it behind. You know, I would still like to say, you know, oh, Rick, yeah, let's do it. Let's rock and roll. Let me script supervise for you and do that. And then jump out and be like, listen, I got this badass horror movie I'm about to direct. And it's really dependent also upon the director because, you know, there's a lot of insecurity in Hollywood. And so it's a director really understanding you don't want to direct their film. You know, you just want to direct yours. And so with the directors I formed a relationship with, they're very supportive of that. Rick, who I've been with for 14 years, he's like, when he saw that I was doing a GoFundMe or an Indiegogo, I mean, for my processing, his email back to me was like, Ree, welcome to the hustle. Here's some money, you know? And so the hope is that that's the experience. And the hope is that I can actually make that a reality. And as I forge a bigger path than directing, that I can do that for other people. That they can look up and say, oh, there is a Latina director doing films. And there's a lot of them out there right now doing films. We just don't hear about them. And they're not doing bigger budget films at the moment. They're not Guillermo del Toro or Iñárritu or Almodóvar.
Or Cuarón, yeah.
You know, they're still very much at a more indie level. But I, creatively, I have realized directing really feels my soul and it makes me happy and I love every process in it. But also, bigger picture, I've learned that that comes with a bit of a responsibility. And that is to, now that others have opened the door for me, to just kick that bitch down.
For sure. Well, here, let's shift to that film you just directed in the Dominican.
Oh, Gummies.
Right? Yes. Gummies.
Gummies.
Excellent.
So this is where I talk about my love of film festivals. I had never been a part of the film festival circuit until processing, which was very good to me. It was a little bit hindered by the fact that, so of everything that happened in processing, we finished it and 2 months later, whoop, pandemic. So then we had to sit on it for a year. It was just things, you know, my mom's like, well, on your first time out, so your actor died and a pandemic hit and you lost all your money. And she was like, okay, so you got it all out of the way.
Okay.
Exactly. But the thing that was really, really exciting to me was this whole world of the film festival. So, you know, the thought, it never occurred to me that people, there were film festivals I couldn't go to because of work or because of COVID or whatever. Or maybe they couldn't have an actual in-person festival because of COVID. So it was tricky having a film in the festivals at that time.
But yeah, I mean, our first meeting was on Zoom.
So. It was on Zoom, 100%, yes. And so it opened a lot of doors in unexpected ways and created a lot of friendships. And one of those was a writer named Michael Clifton. So he had written several screenplays that the festival's processing was winning. He was winning for his screenplays. But the thing about it is, you never get to read the screenplays, but they get to see your shorts clearly. And he had reached out to me on Instagram and was like, hey, I saw processing. I really loved it. Would love to chat with you. You know, if you have some time, I have questions. And I'm like, okay. And we started up a friendship. He lives in Mexico City. We do a lot of Zooming. But after the conversation where I was told I had to prove myself as a Latina female more, and I was just so mad, I just reached out to him without telling him why and said, I'd love to read some of your scripts. And so he sent me a couple of feature ideas. He sent me a handful of shorts. And then he sent me maybe 3 shorts that were 1 page long. And I was reading, I read them all and I could see why he was winning. You know, some of them would have taken, will take a lot of money to make as far as shorts are concerned, just because of the level of visual effects and this and that. But they're great. But I read one called Gummies and it was 1 page long. And I was like, I want it. I want that. And asked if we could Zoom. So we Zoomed and I said, I love your writing. These are the stories I like. I really want Gummies. And I didn't realize just how, like, that one was very special to him. And we talked about it. I said, I really want that. My producing partner thinks that we should take this other one, easier to make, blah, 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 all the reasons. I said, so I guess if you're willing to give us this one, we'll take it. But one of these days, I want Gummies. So one of those days turned out to be 2 months later. I had that conversation, you know, had coming off this conversation. I'm sitting on a movie with a first-time white male director who did not do his homework. And I'm just very frustrated by the whole, you know, process of things. And literally within 2 hours' time, you know, the first text was to one of my closest friends, and I'm like, okay, am I crazy? But I think I'm going to fly to the Dominican Republic and make a short. She goes, well, yes, you're crazy, but good for you. Let's do it. And so I contacted Mike and I was like, what if, and this is like in April of last year of 2022. I said, I know you didn't write it this way, but what if we shoot this in the Dominican Republic and we do a version in Spanish? And he was like, he doesn't speak Spanish living in, even though he's from New York, living in Mexico City. And he's like, do you speak Spanish? I'm like, yeah, we'll get it done. It's fine. And so he was like, okay, I'm game for it. And by July we were shooting. In May, I launched the Indiegogo for it. It did really well. And in July we were shooting and it was done. And now I think it'll be finished. It's in post. The only thing we're waiting on is visual effects, because it wouldn't be me if I didn't have a ton of visual effects.
And when you said, so when you first said it's in English and Spanish, I thought mixed together, but there's actually just an English version and a Spanish version.
There's an English version and
so
a Spanish
version.
So
you won't need subtitles for, except for all the other countries, but still you're covering a lot of markets there too.
I think because I did have to get processing subtitled. Now, it's important to note, I did not know anything about producing, directing, marketing a short when I did processing. I know so much. I didn't even know what a DCP was. I was like, what? I know so much more now. We did have to get that subtitled. And so I think for Grins, I will get the English subtitled in Spanish and the Spanish subtitled in English. And we're going to be, we've already discussed the way we do the festival markets will just be very purposeful. As it turned out, it could go either way between drama and horror. I think because of the events, we'll go lean towards horror. But it's very much a story about a little girl who's 11, who desperately wants to be a little boy, and the lengths that her mother will go to keep her her little girl. It's very sad
right.
and very horrific, but, it was a challenge in completely different ways. Number one, everything went perfect. It was magic. 99% of the crew was Dominican, producers, actors, everybody was Dominican except for me and Mike. And he actually flew from Mexico City and joined me out there for the shoot. But there, I mean, the Wednesday before shooting, everything was done. We were just sitting there like, don't we have something to check on? It was that well planned out and thought out. And I compare everything I do now to that experience, because I just couldn't have asked for more. I feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world to have had that experience, especially in another country. But that crew was solid, and I will say when and not if I get a directing feature, I will really try to take one back there at some point to do. You know, they have amazing studios out there, great tax incentive, all that stuff producers love, but it really was just perfect. Nothing went wrong. And I was really worried. We aged up the character in the script to 14. I did not think I would find an 11-year-old who could play that range of emotions and understand what we were doing, especially in a country. The funny thing is the DR is very, very conservative. They still have a Bible on their flag. I think they might be the only country with one. But we found this little girl and she was perfect. And when we get the funding for the feature version, we might actually age her up just so we can keep Noah, because she was so amazing. And, what else I was going to say about it, but yeah.
Well, I had a question. So
yeah.
Also it sounds like your cast was bilingual. So you actually had the same cast in both versions, or did you have to recast some roles?
Same cast.
So that's amazing. So you could direct them in English and get the emotional tone right.
Now, Noah,
and then just let them translate it for you?
Exactly. Well, it's funny
that's
because
brilliant.
We were able to. So I sat with my producing team, and after, you know, now at this point in time, I understand a lot more Spanish, and I can hold a simple conversation, but like there's of course a lot I don't know. But it was funny trying to translate something that actually, for example, the first line is sugar and spice, everything nice. that doesn't translate. That's one of our things. Pinky promise does not translate. So in the Spanish version, you know, I did make a conscious choice that there's one thing I let them say in English because there just wasn't a solid translation. But also when you travel, there is a certain amount of English that's dropped in. And I felt that kept it true and authentic. Paloma, who played the mom, amazing. And it's strange. They even look alike. I'm like, okay, I don't know how this happened, but great. She's very bilingual and fluent, you know, bounces back and forth. Noah had a little harder time. She learned everything in English. So she actually had a harder time doing it in her native tongue, in Spanish, because she just spent so much time, you know, getting the English down. But when it came to like, Paloma was very instrumental, and I would explain what I wanted and what feeling I wanted and what was happening. And she would talk to her in Spanish just to make it easier to understand for her to grasp. And so, and again, that goes with me being confident enough as a director to be like, she'd be like, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to overdirect you. And I'm like, no, you are collaborating with me. This is a huge help because I'm still learning Spanish. And, I will gladly take the assistance on that. It was a very unique experience. And, I think when I saw the first cut, I cried. I was just like, oh, this is, you know, it's a third of processing. It's 5 minutes, but it's so powerful.
Did one page turn into 5 minutes or did he rewrite for you?
One page we rewrote into three. Because, you know, with the one page, even though it was solid and it gave you the feels, we wanted a cool opening and all that. Of course, you know, I needed my 1 minute of opening Steadicam.
Which could have been the first six words. Yeah, but the first six words turned into a minute.
We didn't even get into the words yet. Right. That's just getting there. because, you know, it's tricky. It's two people in a room. There you go. And the little girl never moves from her spot. And so I'm like, okay, I have to create movement.
Now you want to make it cinematic.
Exactly. Like, I don't want people to be like, oh my God, this is so boring. And not be able to pay attention to the powerful message. And also, you know, with the subject matter being what it is, I wanted it to be relatable to anyone who felt like they're not being who they want to be and they're being held down. Because regardless of your sexual orientation, regardless of your gender, regardless of your ethnicity and all of that, we just want to be who we are. And we all know what it's like on some level, you know, being judged for it. Even the white male being judged just for being white males, you know.
It's a new feeling for white males, but they're finally feeling it a little. Maybe, you know, we're half a generation away from people being okay with it. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, it's a new feeling, but it's valid. I'm a shades of gray girl.
I have a very different upbringing. I guess I'll share it, which is that thanks to the wonderful liberals running California, I was bused. And so I went for several years to a school where there were three white kids and everyone else was Hispanic.
Got it.
So I just didn't, and I was young enough that it just seemed normal. So like, I didn't get the same.
You don't have that gauge.
Yeah. I just didn't grow up thinking everyone in the world should be white. and I didn't grow up thinking that the smartest kid in class should be white. Like, I didn't grow up with, like that naturally just, it didn't enter into me. I was just lucky, really.
It's funny because I said I had become painfully aware in the last few years that I am Hispanic. But in high school, I had the same experience because I was in, I guess you call them the honors classes, the accelerated classes. And it was me, my dear, dear friend Omar, the token black football player, and everybody else was white. And he and I were inseparable. We made sure we took all our classes together because nobody would talk to us. But I'll never forget being in school. And you know, there's that, I cannot remember what they call it, but when you're like, this is an apple, this apple is green, therefore all apples are green. But the example right. was, this is Juan. Juan is a Mexican. This is Juan. Juan is Mexican. Juan is lazy. Therefore, all Mexicans are lazy. That's what it was.
That was in a textbook?
That was on the chalkboard. That was the example the teacher used. And I'd forget Omar looking at me like, what the actual fuck? And I was like, so embarrassed. But I'm like, why would you ever think that was a good idea? But then you kind of were like, well, you're the same woman who named her daughter Delight Cummings. So there you go. You're not working with the full deck. But it's crazy how, you know, your life starts out that way and then you kind of forget it and you move on. And then it, as you try to excel and grow, it kind of comes
yeah,
back.
And then we look back. Yeah, we hit middle age and then we look back on our youth and we see what effect it had on us that we really didn't know. Exactly. That the framing of our home or whatever, the architectural plans, whatever. Yeah, the stuff inside us that makes us who we are. Like, it just kind of happens.
I mean, you know, I remember back then, my dad made me join everything. Newspaper staff, you know, Spanish club, band. Like, and I had to be an officer in it. And I had the Keywinettes and I had to do this. And I'm like, but why? I just want to go party with my friends. And he's like, because there are no other Mexicans doing it. And I just kind of resented that because I'm like, I don't want to be the one that has to do it. But here I am and you know, like, okay, well, I guess I'm the one that has to do this. And I just want to be a director. I don't want to be a female director. I don't want to be a female Hispanic director. But at the same token, I realize that it's almost necessary because no one else can come in, and the people who have come before me, it would have been for nothing if they didn't open up the doors for people like me.
Unfair, yet you're accepting a responsibility, right? It's an unfair responsibility, but you're accepting it.
100%. I mean, I had the pleasure of working with Rita Moreno. Eye-opening experience. I mean, look at what all she's done. I mean, she's amazing. And the last word she said to me was, don't ever stop trying to be a Latina director. And in listening to her stories and how she had to fight her way through and what she went through. And
the career she would have had
exactly.
after her start. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, you know, even my company's Mexicutioner Productions. Mexicutioner was a nickname given to me on the set of Insidious. Long story. Anyway, and it stuck. I mean, it just stuck like nothing stuck before. And I had an opportunity in a weird turn of events. Cheech Marin saw a friend of mine in the Dominican Republic wearing it and wanted it. And he was like, no, it's mine. It's my friend's. And then months later, a friend of mine was on a set with Cheech. And was like, yeah, I'm doing the show with Cheech. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be a bit stalkerish. Find his size and I'm going to mail you something and you're going to give it to him. So I took, because we have t-shirts and coasters and stickers. It's a whole thing now. And I sent him one and I wrote a letter on my Mexicutioner Productions letterhead. And one of the things I said to him was, thank you, because you and people like Rita Moreno and everyone else for opening up the door that allows the rest of us to even be able to dream and strive for this.
For sure. He's been amazing too, because he's clearly supported, you know, he helped people like Robert Rodriguez and others. Yeah. He's done a beautiful, beautiful thing.
He's amazing. I worked with Danny Trejo a couple of times. That guy, you know, he knows exactly who he is and what kind of actor he is. And he's the most gracious, thankful person to be able to be a leader in his community. And being surrounded by people like him and working with them and watching them gives you such a sense of grace about it all. You know, I don't feel like a martyr. I don't feel like the world's done me wrong. It's just the way it is. It's not right or wrong. It's not, you know, you can't look at it as being fair or unfair. It's just the journey. And it doesn't change if you don't take it.
Absolutely. Cool. So, all right. So gummies is...
Gummies. I'm so excited about gummies.
It's almost done. It's in post.
It's in post. So everything's pretty much done except for visual effects. And so on processing, I had some issues finding a visual effects team. And I had done a fairly big visual effects movie and become friends with the visual effects producer. And I was like, listen, I'm never going to ask you to do this. However, can you just look at it and see if my list of what needs to be done is what needs to be done? Things like I needed blood to drip on walls, but we had a cold front, like the coldest week ever in Torrance when we shot it. And so it would just dry on the wall. So I needed, you know, just weird things happened on processing. And he looked at it, introduced me to a lovely, lovely man by the name of Brian Houlihan, who came out of ILM, and he just liked me, and he just liked the story and liked the short, and he did shots I didn't even ask for, and I won't mention here because I don't want to ruin it, but I'll tell you off the record, but he was amazing, and I am forever grateful to him. And I texted him and I'm like, hey, it's your favorite person. Doing another short. And he was like, yes, you don't have to say anything else. But the funny thing is he's in Taiwan. My writer's in Mexico City. My crew's in the Dominican Republic. I keep Zune alive and well. And he, you know, he's also making a real living because he's not making one off me. And so that's the last piece, I think, the end of April.
It's such a cool, it's so cool that you can do that. It's so cool to be in the era where everyone can be spread around the world and artists can collaborate and people who want to help you don't have to say, I'd love to help you, but I can't come to LA. Like, right. Like that limitation's gone.
I think it's been like the most, you know, it didn't really happen with processing. Of course, everybody was from LA, lived in LA. But with gummies, it is like added to the magic of it that I have such an international crew. Brian was from New York, but during the pandemic, him and his wife moved back to her home country, you know, live cheaper, safer, take a break from, you know, everything. Just never went back. But truly, truly an amazing guy, an amazing company. And I can't say enough about that. But even my music, I have to just give a shout out to Randy Whitesoul, who is a guitar player for a metal band called In This Moment. And he did all my music, and it's fantastic. I was like, this is what I want. And he was like, you know, something like this to make sure we're on the same page. And it was perfect. I'm like, can I just have that? So this one, just everything came together. It just fell into place.
Which sounds like it was a function of your experience on processing.
I think so.
And you always need a little magic, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just, again, to go back to the beginning of always saying yes, you know, all of these people, you know, all come from a place to where I did two shorts where I script supervised for other people this summer. One I didn't get paid for, and one was very little, which was fine. You just give back because people give to you. And so when you come from that community of collaboration and sharing, it opens up so many doors for you.
I was going to say that's kind of like the perfect button on the conversation, which is to say, because you started with all the things that you always said yes to.
Yes.
And then actually you did just name like, someone in Taiwan saying yes, another person saying, like, people saying yes to you. It's wonderful to see that maybe this simulation we live in or this universe we live in, you put good energy out and it does come back. That's wonderful.
I think 100%. And, yeah. You know, people are always afraid to call me for jobs and they're like, well, but you're at such a higher level. And I'm like, I look at the job. I don't look at what you're paying me. Yes, I have to do a certain amount of job for, you know, but I do these jobs, you know, the higher paying jobs, so I can do the indie film.
Excellent.
So
cool.
Thank you so much.
Would you want to, do you have a website? This Mexicutioner and whatnot? Website, social media?
I do. I have, if you look at Mexicutioner Productions, I have a website, www.mexicutionerproductions.com. And we also have a Gummies Instagram page and a Mexicutioner Productions page on Instagram.
Excellent. I will make those clickable links.
Yes.
In whatever podcast catcher people have used. Yeah. And by the way, this one, I think these will come out towards the end of April.
Okay, great.
Because I have so many of these podcasts banked up. Anyhow,
I won't hold you to the end of April.
Well, but it's pretty solid. I think it's pretty solid. But great. Yeah, you never know. Sometimes I'm nice, and people are like, hey, I have a release coming. Can you like move me up in line so it lines up with my online release? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? It's not, I don't think it really hurts someone's feelings if their podcast comes out last week of April, first week of May.
100% does not. I mean, I think we're all in the hustle. We get it.
We're all in this. This is just for fun anyway, right?
Thank God you were so patient with me for months.
I swear. You know, the funniest thing is I totally appreciate the kindness. But every time you apologize, say, I'm so sorry, I have to reschedule. I'm like, this really doesn't injure me at any level that we're going to talk 2 months from now or 1 week from now. Like, I'm just looking forward to it when it happens. It's kind of, it's nice that, obviously podcasts are big business. No, I'm kidding. It's like, you know, I spend a couple hours and have a nice conversation. And then I hope that when you are, put it out there when you're making some movie that's going to end up, you're going to be on some stage at some award show and someone will go like, Renetta Amador, huh? I'm going to look her up and they'll Google it and hear this and hear, you know, after your second short you directed and they'll be able to hear like what was going on in your head.
If I win a big award for a movie, I will 100% and you can count as be like, and thank you to people like Jeff Howard. I mean, seriously, because you're really connecting so many people and you don't even realize it. Again, I'm just going to say it. Mad love for the film festival circuit. It has done nothing but enrich my life.
Thank you. And by the way, I saw the coolest thing on Instagram the other day. A couple different filmmakers who hadn't met before, like posted a picture of their writers group. And it was like two or three people have been on this podcast. I'm like, fucking A, I loved it.
See, that's why you need to have a party.
No, I do need to have the party. Not to mention the fact
I'm looking at this fabulous backyard here.
We put a lot into the backyard.
I know, people need to see it.
We're I'm a natural host if it doesn't show.
I love it.
That's a funny thing to say because whatever.
I live in LA proper, so I have no like backyard or patio, so I will take advantage of anybody else's always.
Yeah, I like to joke that I won the lottery on Life Partners. I happen to end up with a life partner and who was kind enough to let me pursue supporting people in the arts. And I get to live here, which boy, I'm lucky. So anyway, I should not be talking about my personal life that much, but all right, I will go do the closing spiel. And again, everything that Renetta said, all the links and social media stuff will be clickable links as well as, all right, first, you're listening to the Discover Indie Film Podcast. So please be nice and like and subscribe. Write a review if you want, if it's going to be a good one. And this podcast did give birth to that TV series. So if you want to learn more about the TV series on Amazon Prime Video or this podcast, the website is discoverindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's always at DIFWINS. We talked about that Renetta's film processing was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. We hold that sucker every November in Sherman Oaks. And you can learn more at shermanoaksff.com. And it's at shermanoaksff on social media. And there is a sister festival that we hold every June. And I'm going to say this for the very first time because I signed the contract this week. We're moving to Glendale. We're the Look Dine-In Cinemas, like a really nice fancy theater complex, pursued us and wooed us out of Sherman Oaks. So Film Invasion Los Angeles will be in Glendale in June, last week of June. So you can learn more if you go to filminvasionla.com, and it's at filminvasionla on social media. Yes, I'm scared shitless to go to like a DCP type theater, but it's going to be great. It's going to, the films are going to look great. And I guess the last thing to mention is TV High again. You can also watch Processing as well as, actually, I'm really proud of the horror section on TV High. So if you go to watchtvhigh.com, that's tvhi.com, or at watchtvhi on social media, you will learn about a very cool, pretty much all indie streaming service that has wonderful films of all genres. And yeah, the angle is it's a streaming service that if you can enjoy marijuana responsibly, yeah, it's most of the stuff on there is really good to watch, especially, what can I say, the art house experimental section, particularly good. But hey, Processing is a visual delight. Like,
thank you.
Like, it's such a beautiful film to look at. So I imagine, I have never watched it after edibles, but I should do that someday.
You should. It'll really make you question things.
Exactly. I mean, you bend reality in that film. Oh, no, I'll be like, I finally understand it fully. All right, well, Renata, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.